we've just covered rationalism, which is the second column here. The example I've given of rationalism is Anselm. And the existence of God is proved by logic, logic alone. And the inerrancy of the Bible, the content of the Bible is proved by logic. Now that quote I gave you on the overhead this evening. The source of truth is logic. The method of proof is deduction. The relationship between faith and reason is we rely on reason in our apologetics. We rely on logic because unbelievers don't accept Scripture, so we can't use Scripture against them. And truth is objective. I have here a cartoon I found that sort of illustrates the idea of the fool saying there is no God. And this is the point that Anselm, perhaps not quite successfully, was trying to make. The fool is dependent upon God and the knowledge of the truth in order even to make his statement that there is no God. And that's what makes him the fool. Well, let's begin Thomas Aquinas at this point. Thomas is the doctor, the teacher of the Roman Catholic Church. Through the Dark Ages, many of the writings of the Greeks were lost, but the Arab civilization, preserved much of the Greek philosophy. Thomas asked, in fact, he requested that someone who knew Arabic in the 13th century to translate Aristotle from Arabic into Latin so that he could read the works of Aristotle. Aquinas, as you can see, died young. I think he died when he was 49, according to those dates. He lived in a town called Aquino in Italy. He was a monk. And that's why he's called Thomas Aquinas. It's after his town. Many people are named after the towns that they came from, and he was one of them. Disciple of Aristotle. In fact, he held Aristotle in such high esteem that he referred to him not by name, but as the philosopher, with a capital P. The philosopher. And Aristotle was being used by the Arabs, by Muslims, to advance their attack on Christianity. And Aquinas was given the job of the intellectual task of heading off this attack, defeating this attack by Islam, using Aristotle. Well, he got into reading Aristotle, and he was so taken by Aristotle's philosophy that he became a disciple of Aristotle himself. And he tried to combine Aristotle with the Bible. He created a synthesis of Aristotle's philosophy and the Bible. And Aristotle was an empiricist. Aristotle says that all that we know comes through sense perception. Feel, taste, smell, look, that sort of thing. The senses. Everything we know comes through sense perception. And Aquinas thought the same thing. In fact, let me give you some quotes from Aquinas on this point, and then we'll get to his proofs. He begins his proof for the existence of God with that first sentence up there. It is certain and evident to our senses that in the world some things are in motion. It is certain and evident to our senses that in the world some things are in motion. And this is how he starts his proof for the existence of God. He starts it from the evidence of the senses and motion. You know, we see things move, we see things change. At another point he says, that longer quote there, our intellect's knowledge, according to the mode of the present life, originates from the senses. So that things which are not objects of sense, such as God, God is not an object of sense. You cannot see, taste, hear, feel, or smell God. Things which are not objects of sense cannot be comprehended by the human intellect except insofar as knowledge of them is gathered from sensibles. Sensibles are things that can be sensed. Our knowledge, even of things which transcends the senses, originates from the senses. So all knowledge originates from the senses. Even our knowledge of God, he says, comes from the senses. Let me give you a couple other quotations. Well, one more here. Of those things which we need to consider about God in himself, we must give the first place, this being the necessary foundation of the whole work, to the question of demonstrating that there is a God, for unless this is established, all questions about divine things are out of court. See what he's saying here? The first thing we have to establish, he says, is the existence of God. We can't discuss anything else, any other divine thing, anything else in the Bible, until we've proved that. He says we must give first place, because it's the necessary foundation of the whole work, to the question of demonstrating that there is a God. He's going to offer logical proof for the existence of God. For unless we can demonstrate this, we can't talk about anything else. We can't talk about sin. We can't talk about the atonement. We can't talk about life after death. We can't talk about creation. All those things are out of court until we prove the existence of God. Like Anselm, Thomas said, we have to start where the unbeliever is. Unlike Anselm, he says, we don't start with logic. He rejected the ontological argument. Because that's not what we appeal to, or what we ought to appeal to, when we talk to unbelievers, when we witness to them. What we have in common with them, Thomas said, is sense perception. We have eyes, they have eyes. We have ears, they have ears. We smell things, they smell things. That's what we have in common with them. And that's where we have to start our theology. And that's how we defend the Bible. You have to use this appeal to sense perception in order to prove the existence of God. Now, Thomas is a very interesting fellow. Sometime in your college career, make sure you read at least a few of Thomas's questions in the Summa Theologica. Very thorough, very systematic. He will ask a question. He will give several incorrect responses. He will discuss why each response is incorrect, and then he will give the correct response. Very thorough. The man is obviously a genius. That doesn't make what he did correct, but he's very thorough and very clear in his writing. He had a system. He approached everything systematically when he wrote his book. And because he's so thorough and so systematic, his work has been the most influential philosophy and theology in the Roman Catholic Church for 800 years. Simply because of his combination of high-quality work with a systematic approach. And we ought to learn something from that. As Christians, we ought to appreciate high-quality work and clear, systematic writing. That's the way to have an impact on a culture. Not to bring out things of poor quality or things in a disjointed and disorganized manner, but to do very good work very systematically. We don't have to produce works as comprehensive as Aquinas's, but if we talk about politics, or if we write about economics, and many of you may be aspiring to be writers. Pick out a problem that you can deal with and discuss it thoroughly and discuss it systematically. Do very good work. There's no excuse for doing poor work. Thomas was so influential in the Roman Church that his philosophy was officially adopted by the Vatican as the philosophy of the Roman Church. Well, what were his arguments? I had the list here somewhere. He actually presented five arguments. The first four he derived from Aristotle. In fact, the first four are almost one argument. And it goes by the name of the cosmological argument. Cosmological argument. And let me see if I can read you a few sentences from Thomas's argument for the existence of God. Again, he wants to help the Catholic missionaries who are out preaching to the Muslims and the Jews and unbelievers. And this is where he presents his argument. He says, the existence of God can be proved in five ways. Not just one, but five ways. The first way, the first and more manifest, or more obvious way, is the argument for motion. It says, it is certain and evident to our senses that in the world some things are in motion. Now, whatever is in motion is put in motion by another, for nothing can be in motion except as it is in potentiality, to that towards which it is in motion, whereas a thing moves inasmuch as it is an act. For motion is nothing else than the reduction of something from potentiality to actuality. But nothing can be reduced from potentiality to actuality except by something in a state of actuality. Thus, that which is actually hot, as fire, makes wood, which is potentially hot, to be actually hot, and thereby moves and changes it. Now, it is not possible that the same thing should be at once in actuality and potentiality in the same respect, but only in different respects. For that what is actually hot cannot simultaneously be potentially hot, but it is simultaneously potentially cold. It is therefore impossible that in the same respect and in the same way a thing should be both moved and moving. That is, it should move itself. Therefore, whatever is in motion must be put in motion by another. If that by which it is put in motion be itself put in motion, then this also must needs to be put in motion by another, and that by another again. And this cannot go on to infinity, because then there would be no first mover, and consequently no other mover, seeing that subsequent movers move only inasmuch as they are put in motion by the first mover, as the staff moves only because it is put in motion by the hand. Therefore, it is necessary to arrive at a first mover put in motion by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. That's the argument for motion. This is the most obvious of the five. This is the clearest of the five. And then he goes on and he presents his argument from first cause, necessary being, hierarchy of being, and finally purpose or design or order in the universe. Again, his motive is to equip missionaries to convince people of the truth of the Catholic faith. And the first truth that you have to convince them of is the existence of God. Now, Thomas said that he did not believe in the existence of God. But I don't believe it, I know it. And the reason I know it is because I have constructed an argument which proves it. He says, but God in his grace has also revealed his existence in the Bible. And he's done that because, well, let's put it charitably, not everybody is as bright as I am. He said it this way, some men are naturally indisposed to knowledge. They can't follow an argument such as I've just given. So God in his grace reveals his existence to them in the Bible. They believe God exists, but they don't know it. I know it because I've proved it. belief and knowledge are incompatible in Thomas's philosophy. There's another reason why God reveals his existence in the Bible. Some men are hindered by what he called household affairs. They're too busy taking care of themselves and their families and their farms and their businesses or whatever. They're just too busy. They're hindered by household affairs. They don't have the time to sit down and read Aristotle, especially Aristotle's Physics, and see where Aristotle proved the existence of God. Keep in mind that Thomas didn't come up with this argument by himself. He got it out of Aristotle. And the third reason that God reveals his existence is some men are lazy. They're not too busy, they're not too mentally challenging, but they're just lazy. They don't want to put the time and the effort into proving God exists. So that's why God reveals himself in the Bible. And the existence of God is the last truth of reason and the first truth of revelation. It's the last truth of reason and the first truth of revelation in Thomas's scheme of things. Now, I want to postpone a discussion of the fifth argument, the argument from design, until tomorrow, because we're going to be taking up a couple of other apologists named Butler and Paley, who developed this argument to some extent. But let's concentrate on the cosmological argument, this argument from the first mover or the first cause. And some things need to be clarified first about this argument. He's not proving creation. Many people misunderstand this. They think that this first cause or first mover argument is a proof that the universe has to be created. It's nothing of the sort. Thomas himself said that creation is a truth that we learn only through revelation. It's not something that can be proven by reason. We have to rely on revelation for the doctrine of creation. Keep in mind that he got this argument. He did not come up with this argument for the existence of God on his own. He got it from Aristotle. Aristotle was not a Christian. Aristotle presents the argument in his Physics. And if you want to read some brain-cracking prose, read Aristotle's Physics. If you think that Aquinas, the passage from Aquinas that I just read is difficult, it's nothing compared to Aristotle. Aristotle presents the argument, and it's a series of syllogisms, which may go on for 1,000 steps. And if there's any error in any one of those steps, of course, the whole argument collapses. If there's any error at all in any one of those steps, the whole thing collapses. Aristotle, not being a Christian, the God that he proved was not the God of the Bible. In fact, Aristotle wasn't clear as to whether there was one God or 58. I didn't pull that number out of a hat. That's the number Aristotle used. He says perhaps there are as many as 58 first movers. And the first movers are not creators. Not at all. The first mover moves the universe as a purpose or a goal moves you. You have the goal of, let's say, eating supper in half an hour. So that goal is going to move you out the door and into your car and perhaps home or to a restaurant or wherever to eat supper. What has moved you is that goal. And this is the way the first mover moves the universe. Not because he's created it, but because he's the purpose of the universe. And things moved and are moved by the first mover in this fashion. There's nothing in this proof about creation, nothing in here about a time series at all. It's a logical statement that there has to be a first mover. Many people have misunderstood it. Perhaps you've read some in the 20th century who think that Thomas is really proving the doctrine of creation. Nothing of the sort. He says so himself. He says that cannot be proven by reason. Well, let's look at some of the problems. Yes. Absolutely not. No. None. And he wrote in the 4th century B.C. He would have had, he might have had access to the Old Testament. None of the New Testament. And his proof is, to be charitable, worthless for the existence of God. In fact, I'll give you a list of five problems with it again, and explain what these things mean. Look at number four. Same criticism I made of Anselm, and it shows up again and again in Thomas Aquinas, where he says, if I can find it here, in his proof for the existence of God. And it even shows up more clearly in the Latin, if I can find the proper page here. He uses the neuter. Latin, unlike English, has gender in its nouns and pronouns. And he uses the neuter throughout to describe God. And it shows up in the English translations, if I can find the proper place. Let's see. The conclusion of the argument, he says, this cannot go on to infinity because there would be no first mover and consequently no other mover, seeing that subsequent movers move only inasmuch as they are put in motion by the first mover. As the staff moves because it is put in motion by the hand, therefore it is necessary to arrive at the first mover put in motion by no other, and this everyone understands to be God. Throughout, he's referring to God again, as Anselm did, with the neuter as an it. And no one understands this to be God. God, no one understands God to be an it. If Thomas's argument proved anything at all, it would lead at best to a physical cause of motion. Nothing else. A physical cause. He never gets above physical motion. That's what I mean when I say in 3 there, the cosmological argument uses as a premise what it is supposed to prove, the passage I just read, where it says we have to have a first mover, otherwise there wouldn't be motion, and therefore there has to be a first mover. He smuggles in his conclusion into his premises. Now, let's look at some of these other ones here. Motion neither is neither certain nor evident to the senses. What do I mean by that? You're going to sit back there and say, well, obviously, things move. Well, let's think about this. And again, we have to put ourselves in Thomas's place. We're leaving the Bible out of view. We're not using Scripture. We're approaching unbelievers on common ground. Does anyone know how movies work? How do movies work? Okay, still picture. If you look at a television, television works a little bit differently, obviously, but it has the same principle involved. Or if you look at a movie, You look at the screen, and it looks like there's a man walking from the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen. That's an illusion. There is no figure that walks from the left side of the screen to the right side of the screen. What the projector is doing is it's projecting one picture after another, one still picture after another, up on the screen, 24 frames a second, 24 different pictures a second. Now, if the projector did it more slowly, if it did, say, 4 a second, you would see it. You would see one picture here, one picture here, one picture here, and one picture here. But at 24 frames a second, it tricks your eye. And it looks like that there's one figure that walks from one side of the screen to the other. The motion that you see on the screen is an illusion. There's nothing there that moves. One picture is flashed up for a 24th of a second, and another picture is flashed up for a 24th of a second. Nothing moves. But you distinctly have the impression that something is moving up there on the screen. Thomas would say it is certain and evident to the senses that the figure on the screen is moving. But if you know how movies work, or television works, there's nothing that moves on your television screen. There's nothing that moves on your television screen. Now, if you leave aside the Bible, let me ask this question. What makes you think that there's anything that moves in this room? Well, you see me pacing back and forth. Jonathan Edwards, I'm sure you've heard that name, developed a theory of continuous creation. He said the universe is so dependent on God that it's falling out of existence, every nanosecond. And God has to recreate the universe every split second. Continuous creation is his theory to develop. So when you see me walking, pacing behind this table like this, what you're seeing is a succession of recreation by God of me. There's nothing that moves up here. God recreates me in a slightly different position each nanosecond. This is Jonathan Edwards, probably the greatest theologian that America has produced. His theory of continuous creation. He said, and the creation, is, the creature is so dependent on God that he falls out of existence, and God has to continually recreate him. So what you call me is really a series of me's, and I never move from one place to the next. While I'm standing here, I disappear, and God recreates me over here. And it's just like a movie. There's the illusion of motion again. And over here. Now, can anybody argue against that? Can any scientist argue against it? Yes, sir, in the back. The film is moving in the projector. At least we think it is. But not on the screen. But we think it is moving in the projector. But given Jonathan Edwards' theory, maybe nothing moves. Maybe God is continually recreating everything in the universe, just in a slightly different place. Yes. No. Well, I don't think so. Emotion means that you leave one place and go to another place. The same thing leaves one place and goes to another place. But there's not the same thing here. No. Yes. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think his sustaining of the creation, his providence is quite different from continuous creation, as Edwards developed the idea. I don't think, in fact, we're told in the book of Genesis that God rested from his creative work, which would rule out the theory of continuous creation, because that makes God a creator all the time. Yes. No, he wasn't being funny. Jonathan Edwards was never funny. No, he really believed it. Yes. And that was part of the theory. And he says, we are so dependent on the Creator. You see where he begins. We are dependent on the Creator, absolutely. We are so dependent on the Creator, and then he moves to the conclusion that we are continually falling out of existence. And in order to overcome that problem, God has to continually recreate us. And all of this happens, of course, in nanoseconds. It's not like something that happens a second at a time. It happens very quickly. Yes. Well, it's his argument based on the fact that the creature is dependent on the Creator. And he argues that the dependence is such that there is nothing in the creature itself or himself that keeps it in existence. And it has to rely continually on a creative power, a creative act of God to keep itself in existence. Yes. I agree with you. He smuggles in the idea of the first mover into the argument. That's one of the problems with it. He says, if that by which it is put in motion be itself put in motion, then this also must needs be put in motion by another, and that by another again, but this cannot go on to infinity. Why can't it go on to infinity? Then there would be no first mover, he said. But that's his conclusion that he's supposed to prove. Yeah. He's supposed to prove that, not assert it as part of the premises, and consequently no other mover. An atheist will say, well, of course it can go on to infinity. In fact, Aristotle taught the eternality of the world, because the world has always been here like this. We've had the mountains, we've had the animals, we've had people. They've been here forever, they will be here forever. Yes, sir? Well, the atheist would reply, that's just the nature of atoms to keep spinning. That's all that's required. That's just how they behave. It doesn't require any further explanation than that. If there are such things as atoms and electrons, electrons keep spinning around the nucleus. Now that's just the way they are. You don't have to explain it. That has always been that way, it will always be that way. The idea goes back to Democritus in ancient Greece. Again, we taught the eternality of the world. There's no explanation needed for that sort of thing. Well, I've explained 4 and 5 and 3. Number 2 and number 1 I haven't talked about. Number 1, let me mention briefly what I mean when I say he equivocates on the word exist. You remember, equivocate is he used the word exist in two different meanings. Thomas says, you cannot say the same thing about God as you can say about man. When we say that man is good, or a specific man is good and God is good, we're using the word good in two different senses. You cannot use the word good or wise or any other word in the same sense when you're talking about God and man, or the creator and the creature. you have to use them in different senses. Well, if that's the case, then you cannot move from the existence of motion to the existence of God. You're using the word existence in two different ways. And if you use the word existence in two different ways in the middle of an argument, your argument is invalid. An argument requires that all the words be used in the same sense throughout. You cannot construct an argument and use a word, equivocate on a word, and use it in two different ways and expect the argument to be valid. The second point here is that sense perception is unreliable. And this is the point that is probably most difficult for 20th century people to deal with. In earlier centuries, perhaps not. But I'd like to put up some overhead that may cause you to doubt your very strong faith in your senses, if I can find them here. I'm looking for them. You're all familiar with perspective, I'm sure. Here's a drawing that indicates perspective. Perhaps you've had the experience of looking down a railroad track, or up a railroad track, whatever, or a road, and it appears to converge on a point. Now, the tracks seem to be getting closer and closer together. They're not parallel lines when you look at them. But you know, don't you, that the tracks do not converge at a point? At least you think you do. You think you know they're parallel. That's how the trains run. If the tracks really were like that, the train is going to come to a slamming halt right there on the horizon if it makes it that far. So you have a problem here. You have a conflict between what you think you know about train tracks and what you think you see. There's a problem here. And it's not just train tracks or books or train tracks or roads, it's everything. You see everything in perspective. Let me find another one here that illustrates perspective as well. Look at these tables. Now, it looks like those tables are different shapes and different sizes to your eye, doesn't it? It looks like the one on the left is more square, the one on your right is more elongated. I have a ruler here. And I want to measure these lines and tell me what you think after I hold the ruler up to these tables. Here we have a table. I have that. I'm measuring the one on the left. It doesn't come through very well. Maybe if I tip it a little bit. That's not going to come through. Can you see that? Well, for some reason, when I get it close to the table, it disappears. As long as it's far away from the table, it's fine. Isn't that odd? That's not the illusion I'm trying to. Up above here? Now, let me turn it around and get into it here. Let's see how long this table is. Well, it doesn't work very well. Well, Well, if anybody wants to do it after class, feel free to come up. This table, I'll read off to you what I see in inches here. If you measure that table in that direction, it's 2 5/8 inches in that direction. And if you measure this one in this direction, it's 2 5/8 inches in that direction. Now, if you measure this table this way, it's 1 1/4 inches, and if you measure this table this way, it's 1 1/4 inches. Those surfaces, according to the ruler, are exactly alike. Now, why do they look so different when you look at them? Now, maybe the ruler is wrong. See, what I'm saying here, I'm not saying, I forgot the camera there, I'm not saying that in one case we have knowledge and in the other case we don't. I'm saying we have a conflict here. And we don't know which is right. To the eye, those tables look like they're vastly different. When you hold the ruler up against them, they're the exact same dimensions. It has something to do with perspective again. Let me give you a couple more, and perhaps you've seen some of these other ones. We not only see things in perspective, we see things in context. Everything we see is in a context. You never see anything by itself. Look at these two groups of circles. You see each group has a center circle. Which center circle is the largest? Or the larger. Well, this one appears to be larger to me, but again, if you hold the ruler up against it, and you'll have to take my word for it, but you're welcome to do it after class, is they're the same size. But because we see it in a different context, it looks to be different. Let me give you a few other examples of the unreliability of your sense perception. Here's a couple monsters. They're the same size. But because we see it in a different context, it looks to be different. Let me give you a few other examples of the unreliability of your sense perception. Here's a couple monsters. One is chasing the other monster through the tunnel. Which monster is larger? Now, of course, you all know by this time you're not going to venture an opinion. It appears again that the monster in the back is larger, much larger. Than the one out front. But again, if you hold the ruler up beside them, they're the same size. Which is correct? The ruler, when you use a ruler, or when you look at it with your naked eye, as it were. Here's a simple one. This is just a couple lines. Figure 1 and figure 2. Figure 1, it appears that the vertical line is longer, at least it does to me, maybe someone else has a different perspective, it is longer than the horizontal line. And in this one, it looks like they're the same length. Again, if you hold the ruler up, in figure 1, they're the same height. And in figure 2, they're of different height. In figure 2, the horizontal line is longer than the vertical. Here's another one. A curve. You've probably heard of the learning curve and a bell curve and phrases like that. Well, curves like this are used by statisticians. And you've got three lines here. You've got C, D, X, Y, and A, B. If you had to pick out which line is half the length of C, D, now which one appears to be half the length of C, D? X, Y, somebody said. Again, if you hold a ruler up to it, A, B. And if I've got my illusions straight here, let me check on this before I misspeak. No, it's right. That curve is as wide or as broad as it is high. There's a double illusion. In fact, has anybody been to St. Louis and seen the arch? If you visit St. Louis and see the famous arch on the Mississippi River, again, it looks, it's probably the world's largest optical illusion. The arch looks much higher than it is wide, but it's not. It's as wide as it is high when you hold a ruler up to it. Look at this creature. How do you like that elephant? That's an impossible elephant. It looks fine when you first glance at it, but then if you start tracing out its limbs, something happens. Here's another drawing. In fact, a Dutch artist named Escher, M.C. Escher. If you go to a library and pick out a book by M.C. Escher and look at some of his drawings, he specialized in drawings like this. Look at that arch. He has some very famous ones of men walking up steps, and the steps continually go up at the top of a building. And then he puts all sorts of illusions within the building itself. And if you study the work, you can see how cleverly done it is. But here, I had the impossible elephant a moment ago. This is the impossible arch. Yes. Yes. Escher, E-S-C-H-E-R, is a 20th century artist, a Dutch artist. M.C. Escher. And they're fun. But I'm making a serious point, and that is, don't take what you see before you at face value. I'm undermining Thomas's empiricism when he says that it is certain and evident to the senses that some things are in motion. He's trying to construct an apologetic. In fact, the whole school of theology, apart from the Bible, and he's relying on sense experience to do it. And I've just touched the surface here of the problems with sense experience. I've got many more here, but I won't go through and show them all to you. Let me see here. Maybe one more would be interesting to you. Here you have a parallelogram. And the question is, we've got the two lines marked here, AB and AC, and again, it appears that AC, at least to me, it appears that AC is shorter than AB. But again, if you hold the ruler up to it, they're the same length. So the difficulty becomes, when do you rely on sense perception? Perhaps it doesn't fool us all the time. One philosopher said sense perception is sense deception. Perhaps that's going a little far. Perhaps it doesn't fool us all the time. But how do you know when it's fooling us and when it's not? How do you determine that? One of the famous illusions, and I don't know if it'll show up in this water or not. No, it's not deep enough. But you can take a glass of water and put a straight edge in it, a ruler or a pencil or something like that, and it will appear bent in the water, but if you run your finger along the ruler or the pencil, it will feel straight. Now, do you believe your eyes or do you believe your fingers? Which do you believe? There are all sorts of, all of these I've dealt with here are tricks of the eye, but then you run into problems when you have conflicts between senses. Try an experiment sometime. Get three tubs of water, three pots of water, and refrigerate one of the pots, make it about 40 degrees, and heat up the other one, maybe make it 120 degrees, and keep the other one at 80 degrees. So you have 40, 80, and 120. Then stick your hands in the 40 and 120 degree pots of water. It'll be hot, but I don't think it'll hurt. Water heaters usually heat water up to about 120. If you have a real souped-up one, it might go to 140. That'll hurt. But stick your hands in the pots of water and leave them there for a minute, and then take them out and put them in the center pot. And what do you suppose you will feel? What will the center pot feel like to you? Will it be hot or cold? It'll feel hot and cold. Which do you believe? Your right hand or your left hand? The water will feel hot and cold to you. Now your intuition, whatever you want to call it, will tell you, well, this can't be both hot and cold, but yet it feels hot and cold. So what's going on here? And that will raise some deep philosophical questions that apologists and philosophers have been discussing for centuries. Does it make any sense to say the water is hot or the water is cold? Maybe it doesn't. But try it sometime. It's a simple experiment. Just put your hands in the different temperatures and put them in the one that has the same temperature. And decide whether it's hot or cold. It will feel both to you. It will feel both hot and cold. Any questions about Thomas's empiricism? That's all I can do in an hour on dealing with empiricism and Thomas's arguments for the existence of God. Yes, sir. First shaker? Okay, I understand your question. Well, he argues that Romans 1:20, for example, the verse in the first chapter of Romans, gives divine confirmation to his argument for the existence of God. He interprets Romans 1:20 to say that men look at the stars, they look at creation around them, and they conclude from those things that God exists. And that's the connection between empiricism and the first truth of Revelation. We'll talk about Romans 1 later on. Yeah. And we'll talk about that passage in Romans later on. Because that's the traditional Catholic, the official Catholic tradition. Is that sense experience, looking at creation, looking at nature, whatever you want to call it, you can come up with an argument for the existence of God just by looking at stars or trees or whatever. And he says, in fact, that's what Aristotle did. And we ought to adopt Aristotle's argument.